Thanks very much. Lovely to be here. I've never been to this centre before, so I'm in a state of being wowed at the moment by this space. It's a wonderful space, a wonderful shrine room. I went to the old West London Centre many years ago, but I've never been to this one. So it's great to be here. So thanks for having me. So yeah, I'm going to give a talk. Not a huge long talk, hopefully. So hopefully there'll be a bit of time for questions and discussion afterwards. But a talk about my new book, which is, all about going on solitary retreat. And particularly it's about going on solitary in nature, in beautiful places, and about one's relationship with the place and with the creatures that one might encounter there, and how those places and those encounters will have become part of the retreat, have an effect on you, and how there can be an interplay between one's inner world and the outer world. Yeah, so that's what I'm going to be talking about. But I just wanted to start by giving you an image of the Buddha. So, as we know, the Buddha gained enlightenment 2,500 years ago under the Bodhi tree. He found this beautiful spot under a tree by the river Niranjana, the flowing river, and he thought it was a beautiful place to be. And he meditated. Some of the legendary accounts, it all happened in one night, but maybe we can imagine him being there for weeks, maybe even months, just meditating and trying to kind of discover the nature of his mind and the nature of enlightenment. And eventually there is this breakthrough, or this profound enlightenment, profound awakening. And then the traditional accounts go on to tell how he then stayed there for a period of 7 weeks. He stayed in that place. In fact, in some of the accounts, there are different trees. He goes to spend time in different trees, 7 different trees, and quite special, significant things happen in these different places. Yeah. So I suppose I imagine that as him, he's had this extraordinary experience of wisdom and compassion, extraordinary kind of discovery of the huge, deep potential of our minds, the enlightened mind. And he's just coming to terms with that, just assimilating that, absorbing that, deepening that. Yeah, and also just working out, well, what's he going to do? What's he going to do next? And eventually he decides he's going to go leave that place and go off and try and communicate what he's discovered to other people. He's going to try and share that freedom that he's discovered with other people. Yeah. So he makes this decision, this momentous decision, and he's about to leave this place, which has been such a significant place for him, such a special place for him. He's about to leave and go off into a new phase of his life. And in the traditional accounts, there's a really lovely story about the last thing that he does before he leaves that place. Yeah. So in the early Buddhist accounts, it says that he stands and he gazes at the tree. He gazes at the tree under which he gained enlightenment. He gazes with loving eyes. Yeah. He just stands and gazes with loving, appreciative eyes at this tree. Yeah. And I think in later traditions, in Mahayana traditions, another link with Mahayana sutras, there's even a story that he then places his hands to his heart like this, and he bows to the tree. The Buddha bows to the tree, yeah? Which is quite an extraordinary image, isn't it? There's this person who's just done this extraordinary thing. They've gained enlightenment. He knows he's the only person to have done this. He's got this extraordinary, profound wisdom and compassion. But one of the first things he does is he bows to a tree. Yeah. So there's a lot in that image. I find it very moving, actually, but there's a lot. So firstly, it shows that a Buddha, enlightened being, just naturally feels gratitude, a real sense of gratitude, a real sense of connection. He knows that the tree helped him, in a way. The tree was part of what happened. That beautiful place, that tree that sheltered him from the sun, from the wind, from the rain. He knows that was all part of that experience which arose with him. And his natural response to that is a sense of gratitude. He kind of bows to the Bodhi tree, and then he turns away and he goes off into the world to try and share what's happened there with other people. So yeah, just wanted to start with that image, and I'll come back to that right at the end of my talk. So yes, retreats are really important. So in Buddhism, we do place a lot of emphasis on retreat, going somewhere, you know, sometimes on your own, sometimes with a group of people, where you can just practice in more ideal conditions, you know, more supportive conditions. There's more time to meditate, there's more time to reflect and just sit quietly, there's more time to study the Dharma and think about the Dharma and so on. And retreats, yeah, so retreats can be really important, maybe even crucial for our practice, partly in terms of giving us a boost, you know, kind of topping up our batteries, as it were, and really, yeah, kind of getting in a good state so that we can come back to the world and come back to our lives with more creativity and inspiration and all the rest of it. I think retreats are also important in terms of, maybe on retreats we can experience ourselves at our deepest, yeah? And then even when we go back to our ordinary life and it's hard to sustain that kind of depth, we can still remember it. We still know what's possible. We know there's kind of depths that we've got which are there and which are, in a way, always there and which are, you know, they're kind of part of us. They're possible for us. Yeah? So I think retreats are also important in terms of giving us a sense of our potential and, being a bit of a, you know, even if we find it hard to sustain that once we're back in our busy lives, there's a bit of a kind of touchstone. There's a bit of a sense of we know we've got that potential. Yeah. And, yeah, solitary retreats are like that too, as well as group retreats. So I really love solitary retreats. They've been a really important part of my Buddhist life for about 25 years. For one reason or another, I decided to write a book about my experiences. So this book is about... It just describes, you know, various retreats I've done over 25 years, solitary retreats. And increasingly, as I've gone on solitaries, my relationship with the place and the creatures and my relationship with nature has become more and more important to me and more part of what it means to be there on that retreat. So, yeah, this book is also about that. It's about relationship with places and creatures and... Yeah, being in nature as part of the practice of solitary retreat. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about my first ever solitary retreat, yeah, which involves this story about the sunset. This is over 25 years ago now. I was 22 years old, young guy, just finishing off at university, just discovered Buddhism. So I'm kind of coming into this whole world of Buddhism, and it's exciting and a sense of discovery. I'm enjoying meditating, and I'd like to go on retreat to deepen my practice of meditation. But I was a student, and I had no money, and I couldn't really afford to go on retreat. Yeah. But I'd heard some Buddhists that I knew talking about going on solitary. So just going off somewhere on your own to do a retreat by oneself. So I thought, oh, maybe I'll go on solitary. It probably would have been better to go on a group retreat first. But anyway, I decided I would go on solitary. And I told myself it was about money because, I didn't have much money. And I knew this caravan on the west coast of Wales. And it was to hire it was £2 a night. Yeah. Even in those days, that was really cheap. Yeah. So I was able to go and do a 2-week retreat for £50. And so that's what I decided to do. Yeah, I don't think it was just about money. I think it also appealed to me in a certain kind of way. I was a bit of an introvert. And I think I just wanted to explore wild places, beautiful, you know, wild places. So I think there are other reasons that why it kind of drew me. Anyway, that's what I did. So I went off to this place, age 22. I remember a friend giving me a lift there in his car very generously. And, you know, we found the caravan. We went in and had a cup of tea and a little look round. And then he said, OK, I'm off now. And he went off and I was left there. And you know that feeling that suddenly it's all quiet and empty feeling, yeah? And I realised I'm on my own. And I'm on my own for the next 2 weeks, yeah? And then I realised, I've never been on my own in my life before. You know, I might have been on my own for a day or, I don't know, maybe even 2 days. Certainly not 2 weeks, yeah? It suddenly sinks in. This is a new experience for me. I've never been completely by myself for anything like that length of time. Yeah. So there was, yeah, definitely a feeling of trepidation, but also a sense of excitement and freedom and discovery and potential there. Yeah. It was quite a basic caravan. There was no electricity. There was no running water. You got your water from a stream nearby. It was in the corner of a field, sheep grazing round about. And behind there were very steep mountains. And then down below, you couldn't see it from the caravan, but not far away, a hill sort of dropped away. And there was this view across the sea where I'd go and watch the sun setting at night, as Ratna Prabha mentioned. Yeah. So very, very beautiful, beautiful place. I really liked the place. And yeah, so there I was, and I just meditated. I spent a lot of time sitting in the doorway of the caravan with a cup of tea, just, you know, thinking and pondering and reflecting. I went for walks. I remember I did doing some drawing, and I remember drawing a self-portrait. I kept a journal. I started a journal. Never really done that before, but I started a journal, which I've kept up ever since. Not continuously, but mostly on solitaries and retreats, so I've kept that journal going. So I gradually discovered the value of solitude. Yeah. So, yes, I was really thrown back on myself. It was just me. Yeah. I was really thrown back on myself, and I could just see and experience much more clearly the kind of weather patterns, the internal weather patterns of my mind and my heart, yeah? The ups and downs of my mood. And that was, you know, there was nothing else to blame it on. There was nothing else to pin it on. I couldn't say, oh, well, that's because of so-and-so doing that again, you know. I could just see it was me. It was what I was making in my own mind, yeah. So it threw myself back on myself in very uncompromising, undiluted kind of way, yeah. I could see my own mind and my own heart at work much more deeply, much more fully, yeah. But in a way that was liberating, because I thought, well, if this is me, I can change it. There's a kind of degree of choice, and it was, in a way, it felt liberating, yeah. I just saw the impermanence of it all, just how, you know, even through a day I would feel bored, I'd feel happy and joyful, I'd feel lonely, I'd feel excited, you know, just, you know, waves of different moods and emotions coming and going through the day, yeah. It didn't feel at all escapist. You know, sometimes people say that about meditation and retreat, oh, it's just an escape. They obviously haven't meditated or been on retreat, because it's the complete opposite of escape, yeah. If you go on retreat, maybe particularly if you go on solitary retreats, you're just looking in the mirror of your own mind. Yeah, it's just there, right there in front of you all the time. You can't really escape it, or it's much harder to escape it. So it didn't feel at all escapist. It felt really, yeah, like confronting myself, but in a very positive, helpful kind of way. And it didn't feel like I was disconnected from other people. You know, I was very aware of my friends and very aware of connections with various people. you know, yeah, I just felt my heart connection with people very, very strong. That's definitely part of my experience of solitary retreats. I can actually feel, in a way, more connected to people because I've got the time and the space for my heart to open to be able to feel that connection. Yeah. In fact, one of the chapters in the book is describes a solitary retreat I did just a few weeks after my father died. And my dad died aged 89, had a good life. And afterwards, I just went on solitary. I took loads of photos of him from various times in his life. I pinned them up round the place in which I was staying. And, you know, of course it was a sad time, but it was also, it was just so wonderful to have that opportunity just to kind of be with him so soon after he died. I could just, you know, I really felt close to him, and I could think about him, and I could meditate on him, and I could, you know, I dreamt about him, and it was actually a really, really wonderful thing to do, in a way. It might sound surprising, but yeah. So, yeah, going away on retreat, and even going away on solitary retreat, it's not about being disconnected from people. In a paradoxical way, one can even feel more connected to people. In a way, a solitary retreat's like a long meditation. You're just there with your mind and seeing the workings of the mind and the ups and downs and the play of the mind. It's like a long meditation. Or you could put that the other way around and say, when you meditate, it's like a short solitary retreat. Yeah. So if anyone, sometimes people will say, well, I can't go on solitary because of, you know, my circumstances in my life. Well, you know, when you meditate, it's like a short solitary retreat. You're just there. It's the same thing in a way. But obviously, solitary retreat, it's longer and deeper. So there I am in my caravan in West Wales. And I remember about day two or day three, I climbed up the mountain, up the back. And so I haven't spoken to anyone now for about two or three days. That's a completely unfamiliar experience for me. And, it's like, you know, we use so much energy talking, don't we? It's, you know, that takes up so much energy. So there was this kind of build-up of energy inside me. And almost, I didn't know what to do with it, because I was quite new to this retreat business. I could just feel this energy bubbling up, and I didn't quite know what to do with it. So I had this urge to scream and shout, and also it's like, I haven't talked for 3 days. Will I still be able to talk? What if I forget how to talk? What if I forget how to form words and sentences? So I remember talking to myself, almost just to kind of reassure myself. Yeah. But yeah, it was an interesting experience, just being in that silence and gradually learning to be comfortable with the silence and to sink deeper into that silence. And now, I just love silence and that kind of thing. Another thing that happened was I had a stream of memories. So this never happened to me since, although I've met a few other people who've said that the same thing happened to them. So in this 2 weeks, quite spontaneously and, you know, quite unbidden, I wasn't trying to make it happen or anything like that, I just had loads and loads of memories from my life. So in my meditations, or just while I was going for a walk, or just sitting there, all these memories about my past, about people, dreams at night. And it was roughly in chronological order. So by the end of the retreat, it was like I'd reviewed my life. Like I'd been through this process of reviewing and assimilating my life up to that point. Yeah. Very, very kind of rich experience, and very strange how it just happened. I wasn't trying to remember things. It just kind of bubbled up of its own accord. And yes, it was like a kind of reviewing and assimilating of everything that had happened to me in the first 20 years or so of my life. Yeah. Interesting experience. So yeah, it was a life-changing 2 weeks for me. Probably quite a lot of people will say their first retreat is life-changing, or very significant, and it was definitely the case for me. I felt like I went back different. I went back changed from the person that went into that caravan 2 weeks before. And when I was writing the book or thinking about the book, I got out all these old journals. So it was fantastic I had them. I don't think I could have written the book if I hadn't had all these old journals. And I looked through what I'd written on that first retreat 25 years before, which was quite something to kind of go back and read all that and just remember, you know, that young guy on his first ever retreat in this caravan in Wales. And there was a few sentences that jumped out at me that I wrote towards the end of the retreat. So this is some of the words that I wrote. I said, so this is me sort of, I suppose assessing what's happened or reflecting on what had happened on the retreat. I can survive on my own. More than survive, I can be me. I'm less afraid of myself. Yeah, that's what I wrote. I can survive on my own. More than survive, I can be me. I'm less afraid of myself. Which I find really interesting, sort of thinking back to that, well, it was, yeah, it was like, there was like a fear, what will happen if I'm on my own? Will I cope? Yeah? And it was actually tremendously confidence-giving to realise that I was all right. In fact, that was one of the other things I wrote in the journal was, oh, I'm okay. It was like, I just realised, I'm all right, I'm okay. And if I can be on my own, that means I'm all right. So I definitely got from it a sense of confidence, a sense of self-esteem, a sense of, I'm basically okay. I can be on my own and it's all right. Yeah. I can be with my mind and it's okay. Yeah. I can just be myself. I don't have to be afraid of who I am. So the last thing I want to tell you about this retreat is to do with the experience of going to watch the sunset. So on the first night, I discovered this. Yeah, if you walk down the lane a bit, there was this place where you could see the sea and I could watch the sunsets. So I decided to make that a little ritual. And every night, slightly later each night, I would go down and watch the sunset. I made that into a little ritual that I observed through the retreat. And there were some lovely sunsets. And the weather was, I was lucky with the weather, obviously. It was October. But there were some beautiful sunsets. And I didn't know anything about Pure Land Buddhism and that image. So that's interesting hearing that. Maybe I was a Pure Land Buddhist in a past life. I don't know. Anyway, so there I am. I'm on my first retreat. Just discovered Buddhism, so I'm entering into this whole new world, and I'm doing it from a point in my life of feeling very lost. Yeah. So I've been at university, and that was not an easy experience for me. I suppose I felt quite lost. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. Just to get a little image from university. So I remember the first night in my university. As a young man of 18, we lived in the university accommodation for the first year. So I was with 9 guys. They're sitting round on the first night, just getting to know each other. And somehow the conversation turns round to each person in turn saying what course they're doing and therefore what job they'll do when they graduate and how much they'll earn. That was how the conversation went. And, of course, then the next one tries to trump the one before. And I remember people going around and saying that. And me just sitting there, and my heart sank. I felt really like that wasn't me, and that wasn't why I was there. And like I just didn't fit in. Yeah? It was a sort of moment of disillusion. I can kind of see it differently now, because, looking back, it was Thatcher's Britain, you know, there was 4 million people unemployed at the time, and these were probably the first members of their family to get to university, and so that was why they were there. They wanted to get a degree so they could have a career, and so they could, do you know what I mean? I can kind of see it differently now, but for me at the time, yeah, it was a kind of a disillusioning experience, and in a way, that's just a little image that sums up something about my experience. I just felt a bit lost and like I didn't really fit in. And I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. You know, I'd been brought up a Christian, but that had kind of fallen away in my teenage years. So spiritually, I was a kind of bit lost, yeah? So that's, you know. Then I've come across Buddhism in my final year of university, and I've discovered something which is appealing and exciting and interesting, and here I am on solitary retreat, trying to explore that more deeply. Yeah. And yeah, so I go along every night to watch the sunset, and on the last night, something happens. So I go to watch the sunset, and it's an incredibly calm evening. Very, very calm. So the sea, it's just totally still. You can hardly see even a ripple of a wave. Very, very still. And it is so still that it looks almost like ice, or like it's solid rather than watery. Yeah? And it was, you know, it had all the colours of the sunset in it. Very, very beautiful. Actually kind of purpley colours and greeny colours, yeah? And then there's the setting sun. And yes, this pathway, this kind of orange, ruby-red pathway coming across this expanse, this vast expanse, which seems to be solid. Yeah. And so I'm just standing there watching this. And yeah, I have this very, very strong sense that it's a pathway towards the setting sun. And then I have this very, very strong sense of this figure setting out on this pathway, walking out across this vast expanse towards the sun in the far distance. Yeah, it's not like I actually really see it with my eyes. But it's very, very strong. It is like it's there. It's kind of an inner sense, but very, very strong sense of somebody. I didn't quite know who it was. I think, was it me? Or was it a friend? Yeah, it wasn't quite clear who it was. But somebody embarking on a journey, basically. Somebody embarking, setting out on a journey towards this beautiful sun. Yeah. And of course, then I went away and I thought about it, and I interpret it in terms of, well, it is me. That I've come to this kind of juncture in my life. I've been a bit lost. I've been kind of struggling. I haven't really known what direction to take in life. And now I've discovered something. Now, I'm sad, leaving behind certain things. I'm sad at, I know there's certain friends, old friends that I'm not going to keep in touch with. But I also know that that's where I've got to go. That's where I want to go. I want to kind of set out on this journey. Yeah. So yes, it was an image, and it was very strong in a sense, I suppose, of where I felt I got to in my life. This kind of juncture, this significant juncture in my life, and setting out on this new journey. Very, very, very sort of strong inner experience, which was kind of mirrored out there in the world, outside me, in front of me, as it were. So in a way, that's why I'm telling this story, because I think that's what can happen. When we're on retreats, when we're in beautiful places, we can have that experience where, our inner world, our inner life is reflected in the outer world and the outer life. There starts to be a relationship between them. They start to mirror each other. Yeah, there's a kind of reciprocal relationship. And Yeah, again, it was almost like that landscape, those mountains falling down to the sea, and then this vast expanse of sea stretching onto the horizon and the setting sun. It's almost like that helped me. That made it possible to realise something more deeply and more fully than it might have been possible somewhere else. Do you see what I mean? It's like the landscape speaks to us. The landscape kind of gestures and communicates and says things. Yeah, we're in relationship. There's a kind of communication that can go on. Yeah, which can be very, very beautiful, very, very meaningful, and we can have a sense of things more deeply, more fully than might be possible in some other place. Yeah, our outer and inner worlds can reflect each other. So I'll just read a paragraph from the book which kind of sums that up, as it were. The gazing out to sea helped me to that realisation. Its mood and motion, the way the sea unfolded and stretched the horizon, shaped and expanded my inner world. The landscape, the interplay between the bold mountains and the open sea, contributed to the weight and significance of what I discovered. Something of my inner landscape was mirrored in the outer landscape, so I could see it more clearly. Something of that outer landscape reflected back again, casting new light on the inner. There was a reciprocity in which the usual boundary between inner and outer, or subject and object, became more diaphanous, less fixed and definite. That land had a power to shape and colour how I thought and felt. The form and texture of that landscape formed and textured my imagination. I wouldn't have expressed it to myself like that back then, but now I see how the more alert and attentive we are, the more the world will come alive, speaking or gesturing to us in particular ways. So yeah, that was my experience of my first solitary retreat, and I've done solitaries almost every year since then. And yeah, definitely for me, a big element of it, a big aspect of it, is the place. Being in beautiful places, wild places, which can speak to our imagination in that kind of way, and where there can be that sense of relationship. But it's not always sweetness and light. Yeah, so just going to tell you one other story from another solitary retreat I did, and then I'll wind up. So I did another solitary retreat, this is years later, at another place in Wales, actually, and it was an estuary to a river. And so it was a wonderful place in that it was always changing. The landscape was always changing. So when the tide was out, you couldn't see the sea apart from right out on the horizon, maybe 2 miles away, I'd guess. And then it slowly kind of snaked its way in, and then slowly kind of filled up. And then high tide, there was like a big lake in front of you, yeah? And then it kind of receded again, yeah? So it was always changing. It was always different. And of course, with that came all sorts of birds, and you could sometimes see the fish coming in, and the place was, you know, saturated with life. And you know, when the tide went out, the seaweed was all kind of dry and brittle, and the water came back and sort of soaked it back to life, and it, you know, you could see it sort of swaying and dancing in the water. So it was always changing, always different, always moving. And I really loved that. I think I experienced more contentment there than I'd ever experienced in my life before, up to that point. And I think it was because of the place, just that sort of ever-changing nature of the place. It was so absorbing. It was so easy to be content there, because there was always something to kind of look at, to be interested in, to be absorbed in. Yeah. So I was having a really good time there, just really touching into deeper contentment than I'd experienced before. And there was birds. I remember watching ravens just playing around in the sky, and seabirds, ospreys occasionally in the distance. And then I found this sort of natural pool. So when the tide went out, there was a place where there was this sandy dip full of water, quite big, you know, the size of a swimming pool. And the water was warmed by the sun. So I had my own private swimming pool. I went for a swim every day and, you know, just got out and warmed, you know, dried off in the sunshine. And it was just blissful. It was just wonderful. You know, I just thought, God, this is... I really like being a hermit.
Yeah.
I really like... Nature is so wonderful, isn't it? You know, it really, you know, it felt like a kind of heavenly experience. But then... Then something happened. So what I started to notice was there was a family of crows that came down to sort of, you know, look for food near where I was staying. Two adults and two young ones, yeah? And the two young ones, especially one of them, cawed for food very noisily, just protested for food, yeah? And it got louder and louder. And then, of course, my mind kind of hooked onto it and didn't like it. And then it got louder and louder. And I'll read you what happened. So this gone on for a few days. A few days later, I noticed the crows again. The young had grown noticeably, especially one, which was now much bigger and more assertive than the other. It was probably the eldest. It cawed endlessly for food. It followed one or other of its parents about, screaming in a hungry, coarse and bad-tempered voice. It leant forward open-mouthed and shouted for food. Then the adult bird would regurgitate food down its throat, which made a disgusting, strangulated vomiting noise. The other offspring, most likely the younger, was much quieter and less demanding, and followed its parent at a further distance. I noticed that I was starting to dislike the elder sibling, and I felt pleased when occasionally the younger one got a look in. From inside the cottage the next day, I could hear the crows outside, and especially the older one, cawing for hours on end. It screamed for food pretty much non-stop. It was getting more resourceful and cunning, sometimes going to sit on a rock from where it could view each parent's movements and flying over the moment one of them found food. It yelled with neck thrust forward, mouth wide open. I was finding it and its noise rather irritating. I tried going and waving my arms about so they'd fly away, but they weren't fooled for very long by my attempts at being a scarecrow. After a while, they just ignored me and carried on. It went on like this for day after day. Whenever I was meditating or sitting quietly with a cup of tea, all I could hear was the young crow shrieking. I couldn't get the noise out of my head. It was perverse. Even though I found the sound unpleasant, I seemed to have got fixated on it. It was like a barb that my mind had hooked onto. It was like being trapped in a net. And the more I thrashed about, annoyed and irritating, trying to get free, the more entangled I got. I cursed that crow. I even caught myself thinking I'd like to wring its neck and cut short its monotonous belly aching. We speak of a flock of pigeons or a gaggle of geese, but the collective noun for crows is murder. A murder of crows. Now I knew why. The way it screamed,
bah, 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 bah,
had me gritting my teeth and muttering under my breath when I was supposedly meditating. I was left fuming and annoyed that a horrible crow was making a horrible noise in my space, on my retreat, when all I wanted was some peace and quiet. Yeah. So, yes, that's what it can be like sometimes. Again, on you know, solitary retreat, you're just there. It's just you and, you know, the wild world around you. And so things can loom large in your mind. Small things, you can kind of get fixated on them, and they become big things, yeah? So sometimes when we're in nature and it's beautiful and we like it, it softens our ego and the kind of barriers come down and we feel a real sense of connection and empathy and love with the world. But then something can happen that we don't like and it can be a bit salutary to see how quickly the kind of barriers can come up again. The ego kind of reasserts itself and reacts to this thing that it doesn't like, yeah? So, yeah, that was a kind of interesting insight for me on that particular retreat, seeing that happen, seeing my mind really not wanting this thing, but in the process of not wanting it, you know, being completely kind of hooked into it. I just could not get it out of my mind. For a few days, anyway. Eventually, I saw the funny side and was able to laugh at myself a bit more, yeah? So, yeah, sometimes we'll have these experiences where, yeah, nature is just there, just doing its thing, getting on with its life, and it doesn't really care about us, and we can't control it. And in a way, that's a good thing. That can be a good thing. It kind of puts us in touch with, the full texture of life. Yeah, we're so used to controlling our environment, aren't we? Just getting whatever we want. Sometimes it's quite good to, you know, that we can't do that completely. Yeah, so it's, yeah. Nature can be beautiful, but it can be challenging as well sometimes. Anyway, yes. Despite that, I think overall, I love solitary retreats. I particularly love trying to go to wild places and, you know, sometimes one has quite magical encounters with creatures. I haven't really talked about that, but that can happen. I'm sure you've got stories of your own like that. And, yes, sometimes one does have that experience of just the barriers coming down, the usual kind of barrier I have between me and the world, just lowering down more than ever I've experienced anywhere else, and the world kind of coming in. All the kind of richness and the beauty of the world just so much more fully being there and just feeling so much more alive and in touch with that. Feeling connected. We want connection. Yeah. I think that's why those encounters mean so much to us. They're enchanting because we're back in the world. We're back in a kind of deeper, more heartfelt connection with the world. So yeah, I wrote the book to just encourage other people to try solitude. And it's mainly a description of my own experiences. But at the end, there's an A to Z guide to how to do a solitary retreat. So kind of various practical advice. And, you know, I do solitaries in a particular way, but there's lots of different ways one can do solitaries. They can be long, they can be short, they can be wild, or they can be kind of milder places, as it were. But yeah, there's information about that in the A to Z guide. And there you go. Yeah, I think that's all I want to say. But just to return to that image of the Buddha bowing to the tree, I suppose I realised once I wrote this book that in a way, you know, on my own level, this is my way of expressing gratitude. I've got so much from those places. They mean so much to me. That's what I feel. I feel a sense of gratitude. And I think in a way that's what's motivated me to write about those places and about those creatures and about those experiences, just to try and express that and share that in the hope that others will be inspired to experience the same kind of things, benefit in the same kind of way. Yeah. But I think that's enough from me. I'll stop there. Thanks very much.